and we're going to see massive defaults in Australia. Massive. Australia is going to experience what we experienced in the U.S., perhaps even in a bigger way. Perhaps in a bigger way. So what's interesting about this thing is that banks have been a blue-chip investment in Australia for many years. And one of the things that made them blue-chip is that they paid out a large portion of their earnings as dividends. So here you have the largest banks in the country paying dividend yields of maybe 5% or 6% a year, 4.5%, 5%, 6%. And that is very attractive to the retail investor. You know, the retail investor looks at dividend yields. For him, this is great. He can only get 2% on bonds. If he stretches himself, he can get 3%. And here he can get dividend yields on blue-chip banks that never had a default or didn't have a problem for 30 years. And so they buy these banks for the dividend yield. But something interesting happened, and that's why I call it the perfect storm, is that if you look at the dividend-to-earning ratio, how much money or what they're earning, how much are they distributing, how much are they paying out, the payout ratio, right? Because you want to know how sustainable is that payout ratio.
Of course, of course.
So if you draw a chart going back to early 90s, we did that recently, early 90s. In the early 90s, the payout ratio was in the 50% mark. It began to climb very, very slowly, but year by year began to climb. We are now, believe it or not, at 80% average and median, 80%. 80% of the earnings of these banks are going out to pay out, and it was an 80% payout ratio. That's very unusual because as soon as you start getting, first, the dividend yield has sustained or has held the prices, even though the price is down a little bit. Stock prices are down maybe 5% year on year. But if you include the dividend paid out, so the total return maybe is a minus 5%. But one of the reasons the price has not collapsed as they should is because dividend yields have held them up. And so if you look at the payout ratio, and you look at what's going on in the market out there, and you see what's going on in prices, and the beginnings of a massive wave of defaults, you know that it's only a matter of time, a month, 2, 3, 4 months at the most, before those dividends are cut. When the dividends get cut, you will see a very significant drop in the prices. So that's what I call the perfect storm. We have out the position. We had a position. Sorry, go ahead.
A noteworthy point there is that those mortgages are not insured as they are in Canada and the United States. Am I right?
That's right. They're not insured.
They're not federally insured. They're not insured by the government.
Correct. They're not insured by the government. And many of those mortgages, by the way, in the very go-go years in which they were increasing their loans up until 2017, were interest only. They were doing interest-only mortgages, and after 3 or 5 years, they become interest-plus amortization. So interest-only was, of course, cheaper to carry, and so there was a further wave of speculative buying because of interest-only mortgages. Well, they're not doing that anymore. They realize they made a mistake, but the price to pay is coming now because many of them interest-only mortgages are becoming fully starting to become amortized. So, we had a position. We've been carrying a position for I would say a good part of the last year and a half. Short these banks, have made a little bit of money in them, a little bit only because, you know, the total return has been only small, -5% or something. It's hard to carry them. It's expensive to carry them. It's a counterintuitive position because nobody likes to sell high dividend yields. You know, it hits your pocket. But we've been persistent, stubborn, and we have now, in the last few weeks, increased the position. We have moved it from 52% to about 68% of NAV, and believe that we are going to now experience very soon a significant drop. We are looking for drops of anywhere between 30% and 50% in these banks as soon as they start cutting dividends. So that can have a very healthy effect on our portfolio. And it's the short side, it's the dark side of the world being expressed, but not so much as a global effect, but a more particular one. But it very much exemplifies. It's almost paradigmatic of what's going on in the world today, a world that is awash in debt. Awash in debt. I think that people have lost their sense of what it means to borrow and have to repay. And Australia is a paradigmatic case because here people have taken on loans that have to be serviced, they come due, and against that they have fixed assets, and those fixed assets now are dropping in value, and it's hard, very, very hard, to be able to liquefy fast enough to pay them back. So that's one of our oldest friends, and I believe that that should be a very strong, should have a very strong impact in our portfolio this year.
Okay. You know, I don't want to belabor the point of Australia because we have lots to cover. And in fact, I should just mention, because I didn't attend to any housekeeping rules when we started the call, that we try and limit the call to about 45 minutes, and then we post the transcript of the call on the Freeburg and the Niagara websites, just FYI. So, you know, I'm tempted to ask you if the slowdown in China has any effect on Australian banks, and I'm tempted to take that question into a discussion of emerging markets. But I think that in the interest of time, let's turn to another home building situation, which is a long position you have in the United States. Effectively, short the Australian banks.
So interestingly, home builders would be sort of the sunny side of our ledger, right? I mean, we had a dark side with Australia. We have now a sunny side. The sunny side is home builders. And the reason it's a sunny side is because we have had a persistent gap. There's been a persistent and growing gap in the production of dwellings in the U.S. for the past 10 years. Persistent, getting larger and larger and larger. Part of that has to do with the fact that there was this crisis in 2008, and that, of course, there was very little mortgage lending. There was a pullback by the banks. Credit was constrained for a long time, so that's part of it. Part of it had to do with the fact that the home builders themselves had undergone a very difficult financial situation. They had to liquidate land holdings. They had large losses. And so again, little construction. Part of it had to do with the fact that because there was a shortage in the market, there was compared to the demand for homes, for dwellings, prices went up on a monthly basis, about 1% a month for years. So it became very difficult for, especially new entrants, to come into the market. And as you know, you need new entrants in order to move up to move up the ladder, right? You have the new entrants who buy the first home, and the guy who had the first home who sold it now is going to the second level. And so a healthy home market, a healthy housing market would see good entry levels, and then it sort of ricochets all the way up to the top. So, and part of it had to do, a small part had to do with the fact that we saw mortgage rates get up to over 5%, 5.25%, and that made it more difficult to carry. Of course, the price is higher, the carrying cost is higher, and now you've priced out a lot of people. But the basic inventory shortage, measured in terms of sales, month of sales, remained tight, extremely tight, I would say historically tight, under 4 months. And that means that the problem is still there. The problem has not been solved. And if the problem has not been solved, the problem has to be solved. In a capitalist system, these kind of things get solved. How do they get solved? Prices increase. Supply begins to increase to meet the demand. At some point, supply meets and satisfies the demand. It's sometimes a slow process. Sometimes it's a irregular type process. It doesn't go in a straight line. But sooner or later, market forces will take care of the gap. So I believe, and I still believe, and I've been believing for years now, for the last 3 years at least, maybe 4 years, that it's only a matter of time before the home builders who are rebuild their financial strength before home builders can meet that demand. And that demand will be met by a combination of A, cheaper entry levels, cheaper pricing, cheaper production, and that's being helped also by technology, by the way. New technology is making it easier to build cheaper. Labor has been a problem. It continues to be a problem. And land holdings are not easy to find, and permitting is difficult. There's been a lot of difficulties, but all these things are being remedied slowly. And so ingenuity is finding ways to get around these things, and we will have a very strong revival in home building activity to meet the demand.
I'm going to say that you also have the advantage of if there's a global slowdown, you have a domestic industry that is not subject to a stronger dollar or a weaker dollar or whether China imports more corn or less.
Right, exactly. It's in a way a very nice protection. It's isolated. In fact, it reacts bullishly to slow down the economy. Right? I mean, that's why very typically, traditionally, home building activity began to rise in the midst of a recession because the resources became available and interest rates came down. And now we have, by the way, the situation, because the 10-year treasury went down from 320 to about 270 or 265, mortgage rates have come down. And now we have mortgage rates in the 4.5 to 4.75 area compared to 5.25 a year ago. So it's making it easier to carry these homes. So we think that the moment is coming. It's very, very soon, and we will see a significant rise in home building. By the way, reports from the field tell us now that we saw a very significant improvement in sales and traffic starting the second half of December into January. Very significant increase. And it means that the spring season has begun a little early, and almost unanimously, home builders are saying we are starting to see a strong activity. Now, you know, it may be surprising to them, and it may be a big surprise, but this is a fact. This is happening. So we had a very weak September, October, November, and part of December was kind of weak, but there's been I would call it a mini explosion. And so that will come, and I believe that this will come this year. So if you hear about slowdowns in the U.S. and slowdowns in the world, that's good for us. That's actually good for us. It's good for our housing case. We don't want to see a recession because recessions mean that people's purchasing power and people's income gets shrunk, and then there won't be buyers. But if it's just a slowdown, if it's just a 1% or 2% increase in GDP, that's ideal. That's absolutely ideal for that home building position.
Well, it certainly fits perfectly with your view of the market being complex, one that is not headed into some kind of catastrophic abyss, but one that also is not likely to be 2017. This is it seems to really capture that spirit.
Exactly. That's why we're so happy about it. We're so excited about that position. Right.
So let's move on
to positions, if I may add, or you want to continue this for a moment?
Well, no, I was wanting to move on. I thought to China, and perhaps we could use that as a springboard to a discussion, a bit of a discussion about emerging markets generally. A lot of clients have sent in questions asking about your views on emerging markets, and I think the answer to that question probably begins with China. So could you talk about that and where you stand with China and use that as a bit of an anchor to a larger discussion, albeit a brief one, about emerging markets?
Yes. China has been slowing down, and everybody's seen that. They're slowing down. They have introduced a huge number of stimulus measures to stimulate the economy in the last 6 months. I mean, not a week passes by before they do some tax cut or some benefit or some move by the central bank to ease credit. But it's not, doesn't seem to be working well yet. And there is a possibility that it won't work. There is a possibility that China is stuck in what the Japanese got stuck. They got into the hole and they can't get out of the hole. And the wheels are spinning quickly, but they just can't get out. And, you know, David, you and I know that that happens in Toronto, right? When we get into the snow, these streets with a lot of snow, and sometimes you can just spin your wheels, can't get out of there, can't get out. So it's possible that the Chinese got into this thing. I don't know yet. I think that the tariff war, it makes it worse, obviously. It makes it worse. I don't think it's the primal factor. I don't think it's the main factor. I think the main factor is that the country is saturated with credit, and now it takes too many dollars of credit to get a dollar GP, and it's just becoming impossible almost. So China, it may be trapped, and growth is coming down. There are people who I talk to who have a very close ear to what's going on there. There are certain people who tell me that they think that the GDP is actually now flat to negative. Other people are saying, no, it's in the 6% area, but still coming down. Whatever it is, it's not good. It's not good. It's having an effect on emerging markets because China is a big buyer of what? China is a big buyer of raw materials, and emerging markets are big sellers of raw materials, so it's having an effect on them. And so we think that the emerging market area is overcrowded. It really is. It's a crowded trade. A lot of people go in and out of that. Those are huge exodus out of the emerging markets last year. In the last 60 days, there's been a huge increase, a huge inflow into emerging market vehicles. But we really don't see any value at all in emerging markets except for one country, that's Brazil. And we think that the progress is, there's good progress there, but we have to see concrete measures, and a lot of it has to do with passing the new pension reform and a lot of the privatizations that will take place. Brazil is heading in the right direction, and it could be a fabulous investment for the next few years. I think we need to give it a little of time for two reasons. A, it's grouped together, and this is a problem in today's environment, today's markets. We have tended to group things together. And so now, when you say emerging market, which is a stupid idea, an absolutely stupid idea, that how you put Turkey, Russia, Poland, and Brazil, and Argentina in one package, it's beyond me. They have nothing to do with each other. But, you know, we just put them in a package, and because we put them in a package, when the buying is strong, it affects everybody. And when there's a lot of selling, it affects everybody. So Brazil will and is being influenced by being a member of that club, the emerging markets club, and that's not good. And so because we have doubts about the emerging markets, we think that Brazil could be affected negatively for the next few weeks or months, and we're going to stay out of that for now. But we will come back. We think that there's a great opportunity coming in Brazil. By the way, just on a sideline, even Argentina is looking a lot better, have achieved a much better exchange rate. But that, most of all, the central bank, after the IMF came in and told them that what they have to do, they're following the IMF prescription, and it seems to be working. And it's good. It's monetary-based management. It's good. It works well, and it's working well. And, in fact, the Argentinian peso, after having a large devaluation, stabilized. And if Macri can win a second term and we'll see more reforms, I believe that Argentina can be a place that one can look to. So
let's circle back.
I
wanted to circle back to China because you had a view on the currency, you had a view on the yuan. And
I forgot that, and yes, I want to say that we do have a position via options. We have an option. We are betting that the yuan will drop in value. And basically what we're saying is this. If they're stuck, even the wheels that's spinning at an increasing speed and they can't get out of the hole, the easiest way out for them would be to lower their exchange rate. What makes sense for them is to devalue and to try to get the external sector to help a little bit the economy. That's the way traditionally economies have come out of recessions, right? They allow the exchange rate to drop, resources move to the external sector lifts the economy. So we have a bet. It's a large bet, but it's a bet via options. What it does is it costs us money to hold our position. It may cost us 2% a year. So, you know, I'm not happy because it's money coming out of my pocket. And it's, again, the counterintuitive thing to do because today everybody, every trader wants to earn points, wants to earn points a month, wants to earn money in a year. I would love to do that, but the best trades are the ones in which you have to pay out. And so we are paying out some money, and we have a put position in the one and think that it could pay off in a big way. It could be a very big way. If it does, great. And if it doesn't, we've lost just a little of carry. We do have a few. We are short a little bit of Chinese equities. We had some shorts domestically in some real estate developers there that somehow they're managing to survive with debt to equity ratios of 10 and 15 and 20 to 1, and paying 10 and 12 and 14% a year for their debt. I don't know how to survive, but, you know, in China, things are not very transparent, so it's possible that the government is giving them some benefits. It's more than possible. So that hasn't worked that great, but we have kept, and we have traded in and out, and have kept short positions of some of the big engines, like Alibaba and Baidu, and even kept short position in a number of smaller other outfits of that sort that I think will be affected. I wouldn't call it an old friend. It's more like a newer friend, but it's more difficult to make money in the Chinese market because we have no way to know. There's very little transparency, and because governments tend to support markets in ways that are not done in the West. And so it's not so clear that you can always benefit from this situation in Brazil. An interesting thought. Many of the Chinese companies that were public in the U.S. Were taken back and were taken private. I don't know how many. I know a few were taken private, and not before bad news or manipulated bad news brought the stock down, allowing the insiders to buy the company back at a cheap price, allowing the Chinese to sort of reclaim back the position. The conspiratorial view on this is that companies like Alibaba, and Baidu may be the next targets that the Chinese government wants to take back, wants to nationalize, wants to have it owned by Chinese nationals rather than the rest of the world. And so the best thing for them to do is to create problems for them and get the price to go down. And that may be the reason why some companies like Tencent went down so much, because they didn't allow them to do certain things. So that kind of conspiratorial thought hangs around this market. But at any rate, the rate of growth that they showed, it's got to come to an end. So markets may be now starting to discount on slower rate of growth. At any rate, I'd like to leave China because it's not been a major position, and it's not something where we think that we're going to make a lot of money, like Australia and home builders, and we have two more positions that we think we are going to
They're all friends. I think that in the case of China, the lack of transparency may be one of the factors, along with an anxiety about how much debt lies beneath the surface of these very low interest rates that have been low for so long, that serves to explain perhaps the resilience of gold. Or if not the resilience of gold, the resilience of gold. Gold's holding up in the face of a stronger dollar, gold's kind of steady climb out of what looks like a fairly firm base. Gold is probably your oldest friend. You have a position now in gold in both the Global Macro Fund and in the Asset Allocation Fund. Can we talk about that?
Yes, and that's an old friend. And, you know, it's been an old friend that sometimes falls out of friendship a little bit. You know, you get a little fight with a good friend, but then you come back to him. So with gold, we have had that kind of a relationship because, you know, it has disappointed us a number of times after hitting like a wall. 1365 is a wall for the past 5 years. It goes up to that level, then it gets repelled back down, and that has frustrated us, and we have licked our wounds, but we understand that. We don't know why this is happening. We're not sure. But we are beginning to see something very interesting. And I want to point this out because, you know, I know that when we get together and we talk about these markets and you guys are always pounding correctly, where is the catalyst? What is going to do? What is going to make this market go up or down? Give us a catalyst. Don't just tell us, here are the fundamentals, here's good, here's bad. What will ignite this market? And I think that I've now found the source of the ignition, right? And that is this. And just to explain, there's been gold went through a period of time, starting maybe in the mid-60s. I have to give a little bit of history if you don't mind. Middle 60s, where central banks who used to own most of the international reserves they owned was in gold. We have to understand that coming out of after the war, gold represented, in some cases, 95% of international reserves of most of the major central banks around the world. Starting in the mid-60s, holdings of gold began to decline. And one of the reasons they began to decline was very interesting, was that private demand, gold was very cheap at $35 an ounce, so private demand rose. As private demand increased, the price started pushing above that $35 an ounce. Maybe $35.08, maybe $35.10, maybe $35.15, believe it or not. And so when the price started pushing up, United States and a few other central banks created what's called a pool, a gold pool. And that gold pool was intended to supply the market to bring it back down to $35 an ounce. Classic gold standard theory, right? That's classic, meaning if there's a demand for gold, central banks sell gold, and they sell gold, they bring in, they withdraw cash from circulation, they create a credit contraction. As you create credit contraction, the demand for gold falls, right? It's classic. Yeah. So, but they've created a pool, and so from the mid-60s on, the international reserves of gold around the world began to decline. They leveled out. Then they leveled out sometime into maybe the 80s. And then a new theory began to circulate around that. Floating exchange regimes don't need gold. They don't need gold. That's the truth because they don't intervene in the market. Canada has not intervened in the foreign exchange market in years. So why is it that they need any reserves at all? And if they have gold, they might as well sell the gold and have something that earns interest. Gold doesn't earn any interest. And so rationally, in a rational world, in a very friendly and rational world, get rid of the gold and just buy treasuries. U.S. treasuries, German treasuries, whatever you want to own that earns some interest. And so then you begin to see a very large exit by central banks from gold. And really you might call it the death of the gold exchange standard. that's when the central bank decided, you know what, this is a relic of the past. We don't need this anymore. And they started dumping. And the dumping began to actually become, it became an avalanche. From 1990 on, it just, year by year, central banks were dropping and were selling enormous amounts of gold. It was so bad that they drove the price to under $300 an ounce. From a high of $1,800 an ounce in 1981, it went down to $300 an ounce. By the years selling, the central banks were like fighting over each other to sell and to try to sell and to try to get rid of the gold. As if it was a hot potato. That occasioned a new agreement among central banks when they realized that what they were doing is they were causing the collapse to decide on a pool, a reverse pool, and meaning you could only, they decided, the major central bank decided they will not sell more than, let's say, 500 tons a year. I think that was a number. I think that was a number. That was called the Washington Agreement, I think. And 500 tons a year was the limit. And anybody that wants to sell has to go to the BIS and indicate they want to sell, and they created a queue. And when you got to 500, nobody could sell anymore. And so 500 tons a year was sold. That agreement was responsible, that agreement single-handedly was responsible for the price to bounce. It hit a low of $300 an ounce, or just under that, and then it began to rise. And it's that was the low point. That was actually the low point of central bank selling. And then in subsequent years, starting from about, I don't know, 2000, selling continued at 500 tons a year, 500 tons a year, then 460 tons a year, then 430 tons a year. Then it started diminishing because most of central banks that wanted to sell sold. Canada sold, Switzerland sold half of its gold reserves. The UK sold, Germany, I think, sold some, maybe not. Germany is one of the ones that kept the most. The US did not sell any. But selling was widespread. That every year a little less. And so it came to the point that there was a year in which there was no more selling, no more central bank selling. And then the funny thing happened, like everything in life, it turned. And it turned and central banks began to buy. And so sometime in 2006 or 2007, somewhere around there, central banks began to buy gold. And they've been buying ever since. And now they're buying, news came out a couple of days ago, that 2018 saw the largest central bank buying of gold since 1967, right? So we're talking about, what, 50 years, the large amount of gold in 50 years. Mm-hmm. And prominent in that buying was China. Now that's interesting. China had an insignificant, still has an insignificant amount of gold in its reserves. It was 1.5%, if I recall, of reserves back 10 years ago. But now it's up to 2.4%, and they've been 2 months in a row increasing the amount they're buying. It's interesting that it's happening now in December, in November, December. It's interesting because that's when trade friction with the U.S. became a little bit more, let's call it, fractious. And so the Chinese said to themselves, look, we have $3 trillion reserves. $2 trillion of those reserves are U.S. treasuries. Are we crazy? Here's the power that is our, not only our major competitor, but now a hostile power. It may be hostile, right? We may be now fighting for supremacy. Supremacy in the Pacific, supremacy in nuclear power, supremacy in trade, in electronics, in supremacy in everything. And so, interesting enough, they began to buy. And the last report that we have, they increased the position by 400,000 ounces. 200,000 ounces is about 400 million. It's actually almost $500 million. It's not a small amount of gold. And I think that what's holding them back from buying more, if I put myself in the minds of the central bank, if I'm sitting there and saying to myself, why don't I buy more? Why don't I just sell some, why don't I sell $300 billion of treasuries and buy gold? Well, the reason is because it's hard to buy that much gold. The market is not that big at this price. At $1,300 an ounce, the market is not that big to be able to buy that much gold.
Right.
What does that mean? It means that in dollar terms, the amount of gold traded per day in dollar terms is not large enough. But if I want to really buy, instead of $500 million a month, I want to buy $2 billion a month or $3 billion a month and accelerate the buying, I have to see a higher price. So I cause the price to go up, but I also increase the dollar volume of trading a day. And that is precisely what is about to happen. So when you ask me about catalyst, here's a catalyst. But it's not only China, by the way. It's Russia. It's Turkey. It's other countries, Eastern European countries. Other countries are beginning to have less faith from a political point of view, not an economic point of view, less faith in the U.S. And as the lines get drawn, I think we'll see more and more central banks beginning to buy gold as an asset that cannot be defaulted on, right? The U.S. could default on treasury, but nobody can default on gold. So if you ask me, this is an old friend of ours. And, you know, this old friend is starting to look better and prettier, you know. It actually now this old friend has a bit of a has a reason for looking better, too. And that is it's becoming attractive, right?
Right, and I think also that it's worth bearing in mind, too, that that the gold market is relatively small. So you're talking about buying in gold is much more influential than, say, buying in buying QQQ. It's not a big market.
Of course.
It's not a big market.
The other day I saw a statistic that the total amount of gold traded, I forget, but it was like, it was a 1% of the amount of Apple shares outstanding, the market capitalization of Apple.
Right.
It's ridiculous. The amount of gold traded in dollar terms, it doesn't compare to the QQQ, to Apple, to anything of that sort, which means that there has been very little in the portfolio. If you look at the world as a portfolio, the allocation to gold is extremely, extremely small. It has come down from what may have been a 40% allocation to maybe 1% or 2%. And that's very small. So a shift, a gigantic shift may be coming here. And that, if there is a shift, if there is a shift, and if we can get the price to break through the 1365 and get a bit of a panic develop among central banks, you could have a market move many 100%, not 100%, many 100%. Because international reserves today, because the international reserves have grown immensely in the past 15 years, immensely. They have grown 20-fold or more.
Right.
So
right.
So a small, small shift in allocation can cause a run on this one. So we have, Global Macro Fund has an option position in gold due in December of this year. We did it by way of an option because the options were cheap, volatility was low, and that is beginning to appreciate in value. And as it gets closer to the strike level, the position gets larger. Right now, our exposure is somewhere around 18-20% of the portfolio. If the price goes up another $20, the exposure goes up to 30-40%, and we may get to a 50% exposure once we get to the breakthrough point. But it's my intention to increase that position, so that once we successfully break through the barrier, we can have as much as 60 or 70% of our acquisition goal, of our NAV goal. The asset allocation, instead of buying bullion, they didn't buy any bullion, but they did buy, and it's easier for the asset allocation to do because of smaller funds and liquidity is not such an issue, have been carrying a long position with some gold miners. And they've done well, and they will continue to do well, and we will increase the position, and we'll probably add to a bullion to that position too. So here's another friend that could become a very significant contributor to our portfolio this year. So now we have three good friends that can become major contributors, not just a 2% increase in the value of three, but we're talking 40, 50, 60, or more percent increase in the value. The last one that I can just spend 2 minutes, just 2 seconds, it doesn't pay to do much more because the catalyst is still not there. And that's one place where the catalyst hasn't yet appeared or emerged. And those are the Greek banks that we were talking about. So whereas we can be short Australian banks and with gusto and think that they're going down, here you have a group of banks that are selling cheaper than any of their other European colleagues. European banks are still trading in the area of 60-80% of book value. Greek banks are trading in the area of 20-23% of book value. They're very, very cheap. Of course, they're loaded with bad loans. They're loaded with bad loans, but those loans are being worked off. And there's plans afoot to allow them to dispose of those with some credits so that they will be in a position they'll have a very clean portfolio, hopefully in a year and a half from now, 2 years from now. They're cheap. They're the ones that provide credit for the Greek economy, which has been doing well. It's actually been doing well, doing better than any of the other European countries, growing between 2 and 3% per annum. That makes sense because they went through 5 years of a depression. The longest depression in the Western world, Greece. I think Brazil was the second one. So they're bouncing. Unemployment is dropping. Business is good in the tourist area and some other areas. Business is good. And the banks are beginning to participate there. So we think that the Greek banks have the potential to increase hundreds of percent in price. You know, you're talking about trading at 20, 23, 25% of book. It would not be unusual for these banks to trade eventually at 75% of book, just like their European counterparts. Well, that's a 300% increase in price. And we have a nice position, so that would be a significant contributor to the portfolio. And that wraps it up in terms of what we have.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you. It's a good time, Dan. We've gone a little bit over time. So let me thank all our listeners for having tuned in, and let me remind you that the call will be posted on both the Freeburg and the Niagara website sometime this afternoon. And Al, let me thank you, and on behalf of all the listeners and the investors, of which I number myself one, wish you best of luck in the coming quarter. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.